Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And welcome to The Food Fight, where we offer a different perspective on food culture issues around Australia and the world.
We'll talk with chefs, producers, business owners and experts to hear their stories and find out what makes them tick.
This episode, we're chatting with Alistair Slavsky about food education, food literacy and her award-winning book, In Praise of Veg. All right, let's try this again. I forgot to press record before, but welcome to another episode of the Food Fight podcast. My name is Stefan Postmagrbic. Thank you so much for joining us. Joined by Simon Evans, as always.
The original introduction was much better, but I'll take it. Hello, yeah. How's it going?
We want to knock this one, get through this one, right. Because we messed up the first one.
Fine.
As usual, we'd like to start our podcast with an acknowledgement of country. So where we are today, we'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which we gather and talk today, and pay respect to elders past, present and emerging. All right, let's get started and introduce our guest, Alistair Slavsky. Thank you so much for joining us.
Alisa Arkadyevna Zaslavskaya.
Perfect.
Thank you very much.
Full name.
Is your Georgian. Where are you from?
No, Bosnia. I'm not Georgian. I'm half Serbian.
Serbia, yeah, right.
Half Serbian, half Dutch.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, and then Simon's full,
full Welsh.
Full rarebit.
Rabbit.
Yeah.
Rare dude.
Bit of a mix now, I think.
Great. So the first question that I wanted to ask you was, what do you tell people when they ask you what you do?
Good question. I say I talk about food. You know, okay. It depends who's asking, and it depends if I'm at an event and I've got one of those boring name tags on. And people say, where are you from? I'll say, I'm from Melbourne.
Yeah. It's a funny question, isn't it? It's such a corporate question.
Yes, and for a heartbeat there, when I was food editor at The Weekly, it was so good because I could say, I'm the food editor at The Weekly.
Yeah.
And then people had a frame of reference for me, and it was just really easy for us to then have a conversation. Whereas now, I wear so many different hats. So it just depends. I try to, the winning friends and influencing people approach is like name, same, different kind of vibe. I just can't do it. You know, I try really hard, but I write about food. I talk about food. I'm the culinary correspondent for the ABC, cookbook author. I create food literacy programs for schools, Phenomenon being the biggest one we've done. We're about to launch another one about regen ag, which is super cool. And now, you know, like, what else? What do I call myself now? Creator of By Alice.
Yeah.
So, you know, moving into the food production space as well, which is so exciting.
So many things going on. Yes. I don't even know where to start. I think let's start with your cookbook.
Okay.
Because it's here and now.
Yeah.
And is it this week you've been shortlisted for the publishing awards? What are the publishing awards?
Australian Book Industry Awards. It's like the Oscars of publishing in Australia. Cate Blanchett is doing the shortlist announcement.
Amazing.
I know. And so my book has been shortlisted for Best Illustrated Nonfiction alongside a couple of my sisters, Melbourne cookbook sisters, so Julia Ostro and Natalie Paul from Beatrix Bakes, as well as Bruce Pascoe. His latest book's been nominated.
Loving Country, it's beautiful.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. And Plantopedia. So that's the category. It's a toughie. So look, to be shortlisted is awesome. Talk to me at the end of June. soon. If I win, I'll just, my brain will explode. But the win for me is the fact that the book is just, it's in its fifth reprint. It came out in...
That's amazing.
I know.
Yeah. I've published cookbooks for the last like 7 years. So
you know.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yes. Wow. And even, so it's been translated now into Dutch and German.
Wow.
And it's a 500 page book. So it's a lot, that's a lot of, you know, it's an investment to translate. So, and it's in the UK. I just got my royalty statement. I've actually made money from a book. Which is.
That's amazing. I was going to, one of the questions later down the track was like, when are you going to start getting paid for all this work?
Yes. Oh, Steph, you're telling me. Yeah. So I think it's really, I think it's real vindication when you can actually say you're a cookbook author.
Yeah.
That does get paid. Yeah. Yeah. Does make some income from it.
So take us back to conceptualizing in Praise of Veg, because and look, footnote to what you were just saying, like for people that don't understand out there what a fifth reprint of a 500 page recipe book about plants and vegetables and other issues and things like that, and specifically international translations, for those people who don't know what that means, that means like success at a level that I assume the publishers never forecast.
Well, does it just mean five times what they thought they would sell?
It no, not five. It could be more than that.
It means more it's outselling Nigella and Bill.
Exactly. Yeah. That's fantastic. It's such a great achievement. Amazing. All right. Take us to conceptualize. Like, when did you first have the idea of wanting to make a cookbook?
I've been talking about vegetables for a long time. Especially, you know, through my food literacy programs, I talk about engaging kids with vegetables a lot because less than 5% of kids are getting their recommended daily intake. But beyond that, parents aren't doing much better. And I realized that there's only so much I can do with, you know, the trickle-up effect. I need it to trickle down as well. I need to engage the whole family. So In Praise of Veg really was my kind of, when I went to the publisher and I said I wanted to write a book that was veg forward, Jane Morrow is my publisher at Murdoch, and she said, that's great, but what's going to make this one different? So I really had to sell her on it. And I said, firstly, all of my insights that I've gleaned from years of working in this space. So I've had, every time that we do a project, you know, we do focus groups, we do one-on-one interviews. I've really, you know, at a granular level, I understand what the audience needs. I answer every DM that comes my way. People tweet me to say, this is what's in my CRISPR, what can I do with it? So, you know, News Breakfast, anytime that I do a segment, I just did one on whole roasted cauliflower. I'll get emails from, you know, Cecilia, who's 80 years old, saying like, I did it for the first time. So that's what In Praise of Veg was. It was a distillation of all of that kind of personal connection with my audience that I wanted to then convey. But she said, okay, if you're going to do this, it needs to be big. It needs to be at least 400 pages. That's what she said.
Wow.
At least 400 pages. And it needs to be like the definitive guide to vegetables. Can you do it? This was July. Can you do it? And can you have the manuscript in by Christmas?
Amazing. Wow.
And I was like, yes, I can. You know, because what am I going to say?
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just kind of had to make it work. So it was a slog. I had at that time, Hazel, who's now two, she was 5 months old. So every day we'd wake up, Nick, my husband, would go away with her for the day. They'd hang out, you know, come back only to feed and sleep. And the rest of the time I was glued to my desk, and I was just kind of, it was like I was channeling all of the info, all of the conversations that I'd had over the years, and I was just having a stream of consciousness with my typewriter, with my keyboard. I didn't, can you imagine? I wrote it on a typewriter.
Yeah, that'd be cool. The publisher would love that when that came through.
Yeah. You missed a page. It's 381.
You said 400 pages. Where you go?
Yes.
You can transcribe. Were you ready to go straight into writing, or what, did you go to the publisher with you like, I've got this idea that I thought of, and then they were like, yep, go.
Yeah.
Or did you have any planning already done?
Planning. I think because I had been writing about veg for so long, I had like a base that I could work from. But in terms of the logic of the book and actually figuring out how it was going to come together, I just had to trust the universe and I had to trust the creative process of having a team behind me who were and are phenomenal. You know, I had an editor who's incredible, Katrie Hilden, who at first receiving her feedback, I was kind of concerned that there were a lot of changes. But by the end, I realized that those changes, that was like, again, trusting that together we were creating this voice that was much more concise than me rambling. By the way, how's the microphone? Should I move
sounding
it further
great.
Away from
no,
my mouth?
You're sounding no. great, professional.
Good, great. And so, yeah, I think that it was, if I had been any more prepared, I don't think that it would have been as organic, pun intended always.
I think a lot of books, potentially a surprising amount of books will happen that way. I think that the author has an idea of what they want the book to be on a universal level and what they want the content to be. Like, yeah. I want this dish in here and I want to talk about this issue and I want to profile this person or whatever it might be. But when it comes to then pulling those things together into a structure that makes sense, it does happen organically. It's not it's like we want to make a book that's about seasons and each season's going to be a chapter and then what do we put in each of the chapters? It's like, no, it sort of happens the other way around.
Definitely. Yeah. It's a bit of shoehorning.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And I think I got really lucky actually because it was COVID and because I'm normally such a procrastinator. I would have scheduled a coffee every day if I could, but I couldn't. No. So I really did have to just sit.
No excuses.
Yeah, and then part of the book as well are quotes from chefs with inspiration for their own kind of ideas for vegetables. And I had lofty, you know, I had my sights set on some lofty names.
Yeah.
And they were all in their houses.
They were all free for once.
You know, free they were. They were just sort of sitting there, you know, in front of their computers for once in their lives. So people like Dan Barber, Jose Andres, you know, Sky Gingell, the big names,
amazing
names that for foodie people, for chefs, are just as inspiring. So what I'm trying to do is kind of meet people wherever they are, whether you're already a really experienced avid cook or if you're just starting out with some really kind of basic ideas, whatever's going to hook you into this book, I gotcha.
When did the idea to structure it in terms of colour come to mind? Was that your idea or was that how did that come? Was that a dream?
It was a dream. A lot of stuff comes to me in a dream or in the shower, so this one came to me in a dream. It was because Jane said to me, we want to future proof this, we want to make this translatable literally, so we can't do A to Z.
Yeah.
And my first book, Alice's Food A to Z, because it was alphabetical, it made it a lot harder to translate it into other languages, so I knew it couldn't be alphabetical. I also didn't want it to be seasonal because so many veg books are seasonal. So I thought, okay, what else? How else can I logically create this? I'm a very visual person. Why not do it by colour?
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really unique and dynamic and interesting way to approach the structure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that like along the way you probably would have learnt some things about vegetables you didn't know, like looking into, you know, how colour, you know, ties different vegetables together.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. And even the functional benefits of different coloured vegetables. The fact that, you know, an anthocyanin will have a different effect on the body, say, than a beta carotene and all of that sort of thing. But having said that, I didn't want to make it too health heavy because a lot of veg books kind of fall into that eat it because it's good for you camp. So there are functional benefit ideas and notions in the book, but it doesn't kind of hinge on eat the vegetables because they are beneficial to you. It's more like eat them because they're delicious. Yeah. And hey, by the way, did you know?
Mm. That's kind of been the framing around vegetables is that they're healthy, they're good for you, and that's the only reason you should eat them rather than them being delicious in their own right.
Oof. And that has set us back so far, hasn't it? Because anytime we hear that narrative, it takes us back to the dinner table, being a kid and being forced to eat something that you didn't want to eat.
Mm.
Whereas, you know, what I'm saying is try harder. Make vegetables delicious, and it's actually not that hard once you start, but don't make vegetables the afterthought where it's just like, oh, yeah, I just steamed some beans and here you go.
Mm.
Like, add some lemon zest, you know. We're sitting in the Melbourne CBD. Mizanon's right around the corner. Their bag of beans with lemon zest and garlic and olive oil, and those beans are, you know, steamed or blanched.
Mm.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Delicious and not so hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Simon thinks a lot about food, and you're talking about, you're like, I think that, and it's something we've talked about before, but like, we're sort of still really, really learning how to work with vegetables and some of the techniques you can apply to them and the way their chemical makeup, their structure might work and how you can use that to do something more interesting.
I mean, like where we've gone so in depth with meat and how you make charcuterie and fermenting vegetables becoming bigger, but even, you know, dry aging meat and all these like things we kind of understand, you know, the chemical, the reactions there.
Yes.
Like what happens if you dry age a parsnip?
Yes. And like, yeah,
might be rubbish, but why don't we know? Why don't I know? Why have I done that yet?
Exactly. And if you look at McGee, you know, I went back to my McGee and I had, during MasterChef, which was almost a decade ago, I had gone straight to the veg and fruit section, and that's the bits that I was underlining.
Mm.
And there's so much interesting stuff in there, specifically about the chemical makeups and the compounds. And something I did learn during the writing of the book, I went on a mushrooming tour with the Fable guys.
Mm-hmm.
Have you chatted to them yet?
No. Yeah.
Oof. So Jim, you might have. So Jim Fuller taught me that mushrooms have a very different structure to other vegetables. Well, because they're not vegetables. Yeah.
You can't overcook a mushroom.
Exactly.
You can and you're supposed to boil them.
Yes.
In something before you cook them.
That's so right.
I learned recently.
The wet fry.
Yeah.
So I learned that while I was writing the book, and that was like once the manuscript was in, and I rushed it to my email and just added a chunk that thankfully made it to the book that's about the wet fry. So the fact that I can learn stuff and then, you know, convey that straight away to a big audience is really exciting to me.
Mm. Yeah. Well, we're just conveying the fact that you're supposed to boil mushrooms before you cook them to a big audience.
You don't have to. Yeah, but you don't have to.
I haven't even tried it yet. I think I saw a video and was like,
yes,
that might keep me awake for a whole night one night.
It's mind-blowing. It works better, I would say.
What's the theory behind it?
So it's more like, you know, you don't wash mushrooms, you don't wet them because otherwise they are too soggy. But if you have them in water and as the water evaporates, over time you're not really breaking down the cell structure, but what you're doing is you're evaporating out all of the liquid to the point where all of that flavor that's staying in the bottom of the pan, you can then add fat. So if you add the fat too soon, the moisture stays in, and that's when you get that spongy kind of gluey mushroom vibe. So especially with forest, you know, foraged mushrooms, where you have to brush each one, you know, each pine cone, a little pine needle off each pine.
I have a special brush for that.
God.
Is it Opinel?
Probably.
It's got to be.
It's double ended. Of course it is, with your little wicker bus.
Yeah. Let me guess, you put it on Instagram.
Definitely.
Yes.
I mean, it's gastro. For anyone that goes trays in the boot rather than a wicker basket.
For anyone out there who is looking at getting into mushroom foraging, there's just the disclaimer that you must have Instagram, and if you get a pine mushroom, you must post about it.
You must post about it. And I know, because being Eastern European, we went foraging a lot when I was a kid for pines and slippery jacks, and cleaning them one by one laboriously is just boring.
Yeah.
So being able to wash them and then boil out that moisture is really exciting to me.
That's cool.
So I'm actually going to a mushroom foraging dinner after our conversation at Grossi Florentino. So and we're literally talking about
it. Say good day to Guy for us.
I will. I'll say good day, Guy. Where were you?
Yeah, exactly.
Where were you?
Why didn't you respond to my DM?
Yeah. Hey, he might. You know, I'll let him know.
No, that's all right. Maybe next time.
Yeah.
Alice, I think another direction that we should talk about is sustainability. Do you remember when you first started, you know, being cognizant of sustainability when it came to your personal food consumption?
Good question. I think that I became more and more cognizant of it before I even was in food as my profession. I was a teacher before I went on MasterChef, and I was teaching geography, I was teaching history, you know, and connecting kids with the humanities means connecting them with sustainability as a key learning area. So what I was finding myself doing is actually bringing food into that conversation, because food is such a great equalizer, and it's also such a great hook, because everybody eats, everybody wants to eat something more delicious. And I think actually making choices, better, more informed choices in what we eat, is a very easy way for us to get more active in the sustainability conversation. So like even to a 12-year-old, a 13-year-old, it's really easy for them to enter that conversation from that point, instead of saying like, you could put solar panels on your house, you know. So that was already in play for me. And then being able to do that on a bigger scale, being able to be on a platform that I was with MasterChef. You know, I remember doing the Oz Harvest Dinner as a challenge, and meeting Ronnie Khan for the first time. The people that I've connected with in the food industry, you know, Yosti, this future food system. I remember being at Margaret River Gourmet Escape. Before we went there, we went to Greenhouse by Yost in Perth, and Yosti was showing Rene Redzepi his closed loop. composter.
Amazing.
And that was...
That's pretty cool.
It wasn't that cool. So, yeah. You know, Matt Stone was there, Yosty. Yost Backer, for those who aren't on a first name Y and end of Y basis.
With old Yosty.
Old Yosty. So it was Yost, Renee McGee was there, I'm pretty sure.
Really?
Yeah. Florent Girardin, who was Yost's, or Matt Stone's Sue, and then came over here and did Silo by Yost.
Mm.
Like, and then Renee was so inspired that he went and got that same closed loop composter for Noma. So... just being like via osmosis, absorbing all of these kind of inspiring ideas, it just meant that for me, it was a very natural place for me to then, as a communicator, go, okay, so this is what I can do, is I can contribute to the conversation by conveying those stories.
Mm.
Yeah.
How does it, you know, come to the fore in the book?
Oh, great question. Well, you know, when I came home, I asked myself, so how can I do that? So I found out that I could get a little Chloe. So I've got a little, you know, we had a little, when we were in a flat in town, we had a little closed loop composter. And so I could straight away, what's the word? I could fix this up in
how
post.
Many words?
I could translate, you know, and condense that idea to something that I could do. So I asked myself when I was writing the book, mm-hmm. what sort of actionable ideas can people take away from this book where they can feel like they are included in this conversation? Very, very easy to talk about vegetables in the context of root to stem.
Mm.
So this book has scrap metal
awesome.
Awards. Yeah. Pun Perfect. Always intended. So, for example, there's a carrot top rigatoni. Easy.
Yeah.
What can you do with your beet leaves? For how much we grow and how much we throw out of that vegetable, all of those resources have been put into all parts of that vegetable, not just the bulbous bit that we've been learning to cook with. So I think that what this book does is it gives people more bang for buck,
mm-hmm.
and it also just makes them feel more empowered to make better choices in the way that they cook.
That's what chefs have been doing for years.
Totally.
And not even really from a I want to be sustainable.
Food
from
costs.
Exactly. From I need to make this whole thing go, what can I do with this part?
That's
Where's
right.
the leaves? Where's the bottom bit? What stock am I making?
So 100%.
It's not even like a moral consideration. No. It's just going to be straight to your wallet.
Amen.
It's going to be straight monetary. This will save you money.
Yes, and I think I'd absorb that as well. Coming from the Soviet Union, that's just the way that we cooked because that's all the food we had.
Mm.
So I think that it's in me, and it actually came out more during lockdown because I realized for the first time I saw empty shelves in a long time in my life. You know, for the first time in 25 years, I walked into a supermarket and I was very triggered by it.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
And it reminded me that our resources are not infinite and we need to make more with what we have.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Do you... It's easy. I don't know. I've got a big interest in food sustainability, and I kind of, you know, got quite deep into it via volunteering for a food waste organisation in Wollongong, like a grassroots educational organisation.
In the Gong.
and then that led to a part-time role with a food fairness organisation, a not-for-profit. It's easy to be optimistic, go ride the roller coaster of optimism and pessimism in this space. Is that something you're doing, or like you seem to be an optimistic person?
Always.
Because, you know, I'll see something like what you're doing and look at your book and look at all the people that are engaging with how to use whole vegetables and not waste food. And we've spoken to Alex from Cornersmith and all that sort of thing. And it's like, we're on the right track. We're doing it, and then I'll go to the back of be walking past the back of Coles, or you know, check out I'll just see something or talk to a person who is engaged with food and things like that, and oblivious to the amount of waste that occurs. And
I think really, see, when you look at the polluters and wasters, it's large companies who are the big culprits.
Yep.
And they're only going to change when there's public support. So starting from grassroots and changing people's habits and making people aware and how they can do things, that's going to push public support to make these big companies change. And they're the ones who got to change. That's why they're like power companies are always like, turn your lights off, save electricity. And it's like, maybe stop fucking polluting. they're the biggest hypocrites. And they make it feel like it's everyone's fault for this. So yeah. It's kind of got to be a swell of public opinion to change. And that, I think that will make the bigger change.
Mm. Yeah, but I do feel like we are on the precipice of a paradigm shift. In fact, it's happening right now. The pandemic has pushed that pendulum much further and much quicker than expected too. And it was something that was predicted by futurists for a long time. You know, there was going to be something that came that made people rethink the way that they were using, literally, the planet, using with a capital U. When you ask me, you know, whether I ride that optimism, pessimism roller coaster, I remember years ago we went to a happiness conference in Sydney and Bob Brown spoke.
Okay.
And his book had just come out, Optimism. And he said that the way that we've been using the planet is kind of like opening a cafe and expecting it to fail.
Mm-hmm.
So if we don't lead with optimism, if we don't lead with the idea that we can turn back, you know, we can kind of turn this ship around. It's going to take some time. I mean, you know, it's a steaming freight train of shiitake-ness at times.
Mm.
But we can't lean into that pessimism because that is where inaction comes from.
Yeah.
So I think in hope, that's actually where we can spark some conversation and spark some empowerment for people so that people don't go, oh, well, everyone else is doing it, so I'll just chuck that in the bin as well.
Mm.
I think there is room for optimism. I think from recently talking...
There's definitely room for optimism. I'm not arguing that. I'm just saying
Steph, don't you're a fucking pessimistic.
I'm an emotional person, yeah. Simon.
But I was going to throw in some...
I get it. Totally.
Like from people we've spoken to on this podcast, like and the results they've had with fish stocks, bouncing back with you know, regenerative agriculture, when soil health has come back in quite a short space of time.
Yes,
it just seems like we need to get to the point where it changes, and then you're hoping that it will snowfall. Because it seems like we are in a space now where we can reverse a lot of fuck ups.
Yeah.
But it has to be pretty quick.
Mm.
But they do bounce back.
And from an attitudinal shift as well, I think it's important that we speak with big business on a bottom dollar, from that perspective. I was just, I just helped open a big apple processing plant in Victoria where their sustainability credentials are out of control. Like they're recycling water. They're using charcoal and UV filters to save 3 million litres of water a year. They've got two 500,000 litre tanks, you know, because they're using a lot of water to process those apples to keep them from bruising on the kind of the train. That's just one thing, you know. Then they're using the heat generated by the plant to power other parts of the plant.
Mm.
You know, like they've got underground tunnels that are putting the wasted apples, the defective apples, straight to worm farms. They're thinking, you know, about that, and not because necessarily they're thinking about the planet, but they're thinking, okay, this stuff's going to also save us money.
Yeah.
And particularly for people who grow food, they need to be thinking about the climate. They need to be thinking about that relationship between themselves, what they are putting out into the atmosphere and how that impacts the produce that they then want to continue to grow and continue to sell. So, you know, I really think that they're leading the way. There's some really hopeful stuff. I'm actually speaking. I'm the plenary speaker at the horticulture, big HortCon in June in Brisbane. And I can't wait to speak with the growers and show them some of the stuff that's bringing me hope. You know, I did a thing recently for the UN. I don't know if you saw that, where I kind of, they asked me to do a takeover of their UN food systems account. And I thought, what can I do? Because I'm always leading with hope. It's just the teacher in me, isn't it? It's just like, what can I do to engage people? Make it hopeful. So I talked to growers. I talked to Con from the ASRC, you know, about the Feast for Freedom. All of these different people who are change agents within the foodie ecosystem, the edible ecosystem, because we can't all do everything, but we can all do something within our sphere of influence and within what we do.
Mm. Yeah, I think, like I said, you have to give people incentive.
Yes.
It's you can't really just say, and we still had this conversation before, go and buy at farmer's market, and buy organic things, because it's not in the realms of people's spend and people's budget a lot of times. Mm-hmm. So, and then when it comes to big business, they're never going to do anything unless it is really going to, you know, affect their bottom line. Mm-hmm. So we have to actually give practical advice.
Yep.
and systems in place for people to actually want to change.
Have you? I mean, habit change is one of the most difficult things to try to get people to participate in, is change those simple daily habits. Like, you know, volunteering for Hidden Harvest, this is the food waste organisation in Wollongong, different one to Food Fairness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it'd always be like, what are some good food waste tips? And the first one was, look in the fridge before you go shopping. Like, that's it. Like, it's like, if we can just get enough people to look in the fridge and make a list before they go shopping.
I'm
like,
so bad at that.
Exactly. Yes. See?
Awful.
And so, like, even that's, like, surely that's an accessible habit change for a lot of people, yet it's still so difficult. How's your journey been trying to figure out ways to get people to change their habits?
Yeah, it's all about drivers and levers, right? Like, what is it that is going to turn someone's, push someone's buttons? Is it taste? Is it cost? Is it, like, for in the foodie bubble, it's probably a level of, like, I don't know, coolness as well. Like, there's that hipster coolness about sustainability too. So I think actually, to me, the success of In Praise of Veg really illustrates and encapsulates that people are keen to change their habits, even from the perspective of reducing the amount of meat that they eat. Because it's not a fully vegetarian book. There is meat and fish inside, but it's probably 80-20. Mm. So everybody wants to have better habits. It's just, again, a habit is something that you do when you're not thinking about it.
Yeah.
So how do we get people to do it enough where it just becomes muscle memory? The number one thing that people waste, it's not veg, it's bread.
Yeah.
Mm.
So even teaching people that if your bread is as hard as a brick, you can turn it into a fresh loaf just by wetting it and putting it back in the oven.
Mm.
I think thinking about different channels and thinking about the new generation coming through, like Gen Z on TikTok, they would froth on just that sort of food hack, that simple. So, like, I'm talking
to... As long as you call it a food hack.
That's right. So Sustainability Vic and I are going to do something. I'm trying to convince him to do an ASMR video.
Oh, really?
Just like... and then it goes like... the steam. I think that will go
ASMR is universal.
Getting
far outside of Victoria with some quality ASMR content.
Good.
Have you done any of that yet? Have you done any ASMR stuff yet?
I think I need to, though.
Yeah.
Sometimes I do it just in my Insta stories, just like for shits and giggles, because... like, there's only so many different tracks you can choose on music.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'll do my own little, like, dee-dee-dee-dee-dee, or I'll just sizzling things in a pan. Oof.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, food is so multi-sensory, isn't it? Mm. Very sensual.
Yeah.
Yeah.
excuse me. Let's.
Was that a bit of ASMR? Yeah. Please enjoy this frog in my throat.
Let's talk about the work you do with schools and food literacy. Mm. For those people, let's give them a little overview about the issues we face. Like, I think that people who listen to this podcast particularly are interested in food. Mm. And, you know, I mean, if you're going to sit here and listen to us talk to a chef about, you know, the front of house, back of house dynamic and how they mitigate, you know, system breakdowns when trying to get the saucier to provide consistent
consistency
to the past.
What's the best
spreadsheet method? Like, if people are going to listen to that, then they're going to be interested in food universally.
You'd hope, but no hope for them.
I think that, and I think those people who are interested in food might be a bit insulated from the issues of food literacy that we have in Australia. So, do you want to give us a bit of a rundown and then tell us about the work that you're doing?
We are definitely in a foodie bubble, and I do have to remind myself that not everybody loves food the way that I do, and I don't necessarily want everybody to be a foodie because that's an unrealistic kind of push for some people. We're all on a spectrum of our understanding of food. I just want people to be further along in how much joy food brings them and in how empowered they feel to make the choices that they want to make themselves feel better, to make better, more conscious decisions for the planet and for their community. So that is what food literacy means to me. The notion of food literacy, I mean, it's a made-up term, isn't it?
Mm.
Literacy people understand because we value the ability to write and read. We value numeracy, the ability to count. But food literacy, the ability to understand how food connects us, what food does for us, how we can grow our own, all of those sorts of things, I think has been lost, particularly in the school system, because the curriculum is overloaded. Depending on how much a teacher or a school values food, it has a completely different kind of influence on a school. If you get a principal that's super engaged or a teacher that's extremely excited, you've got a kitchen garden scheme. You've got a little patch that the kids are growing, or, you know, the kids are bringing in food. I remember when I was humanities, you know, head of HUMS at a top tier school in Melbourne, I would get the kids to bring in feasts for like history day. So like we'd have like Ancients Day. We had a big ancient feast, or like, you know, Medieval Day. We had a big medieval feast. But that was because I was driving that. And if I wasn't there, then that might not necessarily have happened for those kids. I still see those kids. They're in their 20s. That's the stuff they remember. So we have the power at that level to engage with kids. I mentioned food being multisensory. That's what you want to do as a teacher, is like capture a kid's attention and their imagination. I think food can do that. So it's not just that we have the opportunity to improve food literacy in schools by including food in the curriculum. It's that we have the power to engage kids more in learning by bringing more food in. And when I talk about the foodie bubble, I remember when I launched my first book. So Alice's Food A to Z was essentially just a textbook for kids about food. And may I say, as an exclusive, I haven't even announced this yet. When is this going to air?
I reckon next week, next Monday.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. So keep your eyes peeled. Put a pin in that conversation. Keep your eyes peeled. So I was visiting schools. I was out in Punchbowl in Sydney, and I was talking about making your own sauce. And I was definitely, I'd just come out of MasterChef, you know, I was like, oh, everybody loves food. Woohoo. Here's a jus. And I was talking about sauces, making your own mayonnaise, yada yada, and I said, okay, who wants to tell me their favorite sauce? And there was a kid that put his hand up, little you know, really excitable little kid, like, you know, and everyone's kind of giggling straight away. They're like, oh, this guy, you know, you could tell he was a bit of a joke,
sitting up straight.
Who's this guy? And he said, Big Mac sauce. And everybody laughed.
He's got a point, though. Like,
everybody laughed. And I thought, oh, okay, here we go, right? It's not this kid's fault that that's the sauce that he wants. I've got the opportunity now. So I can either shame him and say, oh, no, that's not what I meant. You know, oh, no, no, I meant a fresh salsa, or, you know, or let's turn this into a learning and let's hook this kid in where he is on that spectrum.
Yeah, he'll love being a chef. If he loves Big Mac sauce.
If he loves Big Mac sauce, he knows umami, right? He loves rich, creamy, all of those flavors. Like, there's a reason that Big Mac sauce sells, right? Yeah. So I said, all right, young man, what is your name? He said, Mike. I said, all right. Thank you, universe. So I said, let's make Big Mike's sauce.
Perfect.
Right? And then we made Big Mike's sauce. So it has a mayonnaise base. You know, we might pop some pickles in there. We might put some onion in there or whatever it is. And we made our own, you know, a bit of tomato sauce in there. Right, Mike? You know, all of those sorts of things. And straight away, he sat up straighter. He felt like he could be included in that conversation. That's what food literacy is. It's not about saying go to the farmer's market or only eat organic or whatever it is. It's actually just saying, hey, you know, you can be part of this. Be more active, like be an active participant in what it is that you feed yourself, and go with your taste buds. If you're craving something rich, creamy, umami, savory, figure out what's in your fridge and what you can do to make that happen for yourself. You know, learn to cook. You can do that, Mike.
You've mentioned schools' curriculums and how they impact, you know, someone like yourselves' ability to communicate and teachers' ability.
Just for someone who didn't go to school here and doesn't have any children, what is in the curriculum to do with food in Australian schools? Because in the UK, we did like one term of cooking. I burnt some pasta and that was it. I think we made a pie.
Yeah.
That was it. Didn't like it.
I did bugger all. Boring. You didn't do much.
Bugger all. Yeah, and it very much is. So the Australian curriculum, I don't know how it... In the UK, it's actually not so different. So teachers are given a framework. Yes, teachers are given a framework of, you know, tick boxes. So you need to teach, statistics. You need to do blah, 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 blah. Food is more like an auxiliary kind of element. There might be a unit on nutrition, or there might be something, you know... the food pyramid, which Like, if that's in your curriculum, rethink, you know, your choices. So it's up to the teachers to design it themselves. And unfortunately, what happens there is that teachers bring their own baggage with food. Like, as grown-ups, you know, we've got years of scar tissue of what food means to us. And so to get a teacher who might not be informed enough in terms of the language that they're using or the approach for a kid understanding of food, because one thing that we don't understand as grown-ups is that, or might not understand, is that kids don't see as much nuance as we do. They see things in black and white. So if I had said to Mike, that sauce is junk food, Mike wouldn't say, oh yeah, that's junk food, I shouldn't eat it. Mike would say, I eat that, I am junk. So when teachers police lunchboxes, when teachers talk about sometimes foods good and bad, you know, black and white thinking for kids, they absorb that and they can't control what they eat. They go home and mum and dad put food on the table. And so I think that what we have the opportunity to do though with that open curriculum is find the curiosity points, the entry points about food, like the history of food, the language of food, like where does the word mayonnaise come from? And how come the French own so many food words around the world? Isn't that interesting? So I think that's a really exciting thing for me, to be encouraging teachers to think differently about food. And what's even more exciting, so Phenomenon, which is all free. It's something that we created, Phenomenon with an M.com.au, if you're curious. Thank you. It's something that we created with funds from the federal government and industry. So Hort Innovation, who represent growers, they, you know, growers pay a levy for every piece of fruit and veg that they sell. They've put some of those levy funds, close to $2 million, into this project to make it free, to make it accessible to every teacher, you know. And I think that's showing that there are some real forward thinkers. Big, you know, there's big money in food and they're thinking about the future of it.
The fact is, it's not as important in schools, or it's an afterthought, if it's left up to the teachers to do it, is insane. One that's asking a massive amount from a teacher who are already snowed under and busy, and it's just, it's so short-sighted. It's like, we literally need food.
I think... Not only are they snowed under and short-sighted too, but like, you know, my sister's a teacher and I've got friends that are teachers and stuff like that. It's so much of this stuff that teachers are passionate about that they have to pursue in their own time.
Yes.
Teachers have so much extracurricular stuff that they need to pursue. So
Teachers need holidays because we are fucking exhausted. Sorry. No, I'm not going to apologize. This is foodie people. Freaking exhausted. And so people think, oh, being a teacher, you know, that's like a 8-to-3 job, right? No way. Yeah. The reason that I ended up on MasterChef is because I had pitched this food and culture elective to my heads of school and they said, you don't have the expertise. I went out every weekend for a year and did a chef at home course at William Angus, you know, because I wanted to upskill, because that was my passion. But if I'm not a teacher that's interested in food and then I'm told, oh, you've got to teach a semester of food stuff, I'd be like, what? What do you mean? So, you know, I think for me, my passion is food, but someone else might come in and say cyberbullying. Cyberbullying is very, very important. It's a very, you know, so slip that into your curriculum. So it is, it's a very cluttered space to be in. So I think that it's about finding the gaps rather than trying to shove more in.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Or just ripping it all down and starting again. That's just
100%
kids!
That's just my thoughts for the schooling system.
For the next year, all we're doing is cooking.
Just burn it down, honestly.
How have you seen, and it's a cool little link, but my niece is 8 years old and she loves MasterChef more than anything in the world. And she does her own little MasterChef challenges at home with her mum and stuff like that. And like, she cooked dinner for her parents the other night. She's
That's
8.
Wild.
She cooked pasta with carrots. It was quite nice, apparently. But like, how do you see the popularity of shows like MasterChef? Because like YouTube and, you know, food social media, food content is so accessible and consumable and to a really, really young demographic.
Yes.
Like, have you, since you were on MasterChef or since you were a teacher, have you seen, you know, media being a place to really push forward food literacy?
Oh, Absolutely. When I went on the show, I thought I'd be coming back into the classroom when I was done. And I went back to visit my kids and they were like, oh my God, it's Alice from MasterChef. And they were so excited. And I was like, I taught you for 3 years. Yeah. I'm literally the same person. And suddenly I've got all this, you know, cachet for you.
I was here last week.
I was here. I'm literally the same. And so I definitely think that MasterChef is a juggernaut. Yeah. And particularly for kids. I think the way it's produced is for kids.
Yeah.
You know, it's very much the, it's quite panto.
Yeah.
And families watch it together. And I definitely think it's changed even the vernacular that we use around food, plating up, heroing, all of these
hibachi,
all of these terms that
Mama want a hibachi for Christmas.
just get a pot plant, put a grate on it, yeah. get some charcoal in there. So that definitely, I think that there has been a lot of good that's come from cooking TV, as long as we keep it positive. And I think that that's what MasterChef does really well, is that there's a hopefulness and a positivity to it, a camaraderie that you might not see on other competitive cooking shows. And I do think that TikTok is for the Gen Z. That's where they are, and that is food hacks. You know, the tortilla hack, the baked feta pasta. You know, feta sold out in the United States.
That's crazy. Like crazy. Viral feta pasta.
It's one of those ones I'm like, people don't know that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm like, what?
How do we do that with butternut squash? You know, like, and we can. I bet you just the same, cherry tomatoes would have sold out at the same time.
I mean, it's almost the way that a lot of chefs and restaurants think about what dish can go viral. Yes. If you think about it the same way with social media and TikTok, like, what can we do? What recipe could really kick off and make people go out and buy up all the pumpkins?
And obviously, it does, like, we're talking about it in very positive terms. So there are negatives to social media, even social media in the food space. But I'm all about reviewing by omission.
Yeah,
okay. So if I don't talk about it, I don't give it oxygen, and I put my energy and attention into the things that are good.
Fantastic. Last thing we'll talk about before we wrap up. But having... You know, you're a teacher, but having been on MasterChef and now, and you know, that potentially providing you a springboard into the food world, which is what you've sort of taken that opportunity, done a lot of hard work to get to where you are. MasterChef was 10 years ago?
Yeah, close to.
Did you always, like, while you were on MasterChef or previous to that, or like, when along the line did you think, I want to make a career in the food world? And I mean, it's... wearing so many hats and not really having a defined job where you get paid a salary and all that sort of thing. It's like you don't just think of this in your head as something you wanted to do. Like, you kind of just think this, like, cloud of ethereal, like, I want to be in the food world and communicate my ideas and do these sorts of things. Like, I face the same issues because I make cookbooks and take photos of food and do contract work and consulting and a podcast and radio. And I'm still trying to figure out how I turn that into a, like, real job, if you know what I mean. Yeah. But, like, how's that journey been for you? And did you have to really think about along the way how you would go through that process and turn it into a career? Or is it something that happened organically?
Oh, man. Very good question. When I went on the show, I mentioned I was planning on going back into the classroom and just teaching my food and culture elective. So during the process of the show, as I got further and further along, actually, you know, a week in, so I had been told that I could come back to my job, and a week in it was like, if you don't come to work on Monday morning, you don't have a job. So that was the first leap that I took. That was the first big leap of faith.
Didn't come in.
Did not come in. In comes Matt Moran with a big salmon on his back and all of his chefs.
He always walks around with
a salmon. Yeah, just a salmon. Hey, here's me and my salmon. Slammed it down and said, you know, today if you cook, then you either get an apron or you go home. And if you don't cook, if you step back, then you've got just the day off, you know, take your time. I was just like, I'm free falling right now.
Yeah.
So I'm going in. Yeah. And that was the day I got my apron.
Amazing.
The rest of the last decade has been a matter of organically listening. When I'm really tapped in, I get moments of, you are where you need to be right now. And not always, you know, there have been times where I've just felt like, oh, this is not good for me. And that intuition has been almost always right.
Yeah.
And I think the thing that I did that's always kept me and my rudder quite stable, you know, is that I put a big piece of paper up and I wrote teacher, but bigger on the wall. And every decision that I've made since is asking that question, is this doing that? And that is the thing that I think has kept my authenticity, has kept me feeling good about what I do. And I don't always get paid. Yeah. There's a lot of stuff that I do for free, but no learning is pointless. You know, so every free thing that I've done, I tend to find that, you know, for example, saying yes to something like this, you know, now I've connected with you and with Simon, and I can say, you know, somewhere down the line, something will be there and I'll think, okay, Steph is right for this. Let me get in touch with him. So I'm a people person. You know, I'm a very gregarious person. I'm energized by other people's energy and enthusiasm. And that is something that is, I think, better than feeling like I'm getting a wage. You know, now I'd probably be principal of a school.
Yeah.
But there's only so much that I can, you know.
Of course.
There's only so many students you can teach in a classroom.
Yeah.
Whereas I get to go on national television of a morning and inspire hundreds of thousands of people to whole roast a cauliflower.
Mm.
That's pretty freaking cool.
Very exciting. All right. That's just the perfect way to end it. So we're going to end it there. Alice, thank you so much for joining us. It's been fantastic.
Thank you, Steph. Thank you, Simon. Over and out. Fireball.
Hello, dear listeners. Steph here. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of The Food Fight. If you want to get in touch with us, it's at The Food Fight Podcast on Instagram or thefoodfightpodcast@gmail.com. We want to hear from you and we want to talk to you. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really helps. If you want to hit me up, it's quicksandfood.com or at quicksandfood on Instagram. And if you want to get in touch with Simon, it's Simon_Evans_TBD on Instagram. Thanks so much for tuning in and we'll catch you again with another episode.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.